I was wondering today about how good you are at reading the signs. I'm not talking about traffic signs, and I'm not talking about signs at the supermarket, but rather the signs of the times. How good are you seeing things beginning to develop and being able to deduce the inevitable outcome of those signs? I'm not talking about apocalyptic signs today. For I ran across a list of some signs that should you see these things, you know you're in for a very, very bad day. Some examples of these signs are as follows. You receive a phone call from the producers of the Jerry Springer show asking if you'd like to appear on the next episode with your spouse. You're in for a bad day. Another surefire bad sign is that you show up for work and a television crew from W5 is camped out in the lobby of the building. Another bad sign is that you turn on your television and they're showing people the quickest way to evacuate the city. You know it's a really bad day when your twin sister forgets your birthday, right, Wendy? You know it's going to be a bad day when you arrive at work and your boss says to you not to bother to take off your coat. Oh, it's a bad day when your check to Revenue Canada bounces. It's a really bad day when your car horn accidentally goes off and remains blaring all the way you're driving along following a group of Hell's Angels bikers. And you know it's a really bad day when your daughter's new boyfriend arrives at your house wearing a tracking anklet. Now, I'm sure all of us, we could sit around for some time and come up with numerous other little signs that you're in for a bad day. One bad day is enough. But when you experience a few bad days in a row, it is tempting to throw in the towel, to just give up. Warren Wiersbe, in his book, Be Daring, tells the story of a man who was out shoveling his driveway after a heavy snowfall. He was about halfway through clearing his driveway when two young men approached carrying shovels. One of the young men said, "Can we shovel your snow, mister? Only $2. Must have been a few years ago. Puzzled by the question, the man replied, "Well, can't you see that I'm doing it myself and I'm already half finished?" "Sure," the one lad said, "that's why we asked you. We get most of our business from people who are halfway through and feel like quitting." You ever feel like quitting? Quitting your job, quitting your marriage, quitting your church, perhaps, Lord forbid, quitting your own life. I think that you and I, we can agree that nothing is more harmful to the human condition than discouragement. Something that I've talked about often with you. What I want to tell you today is that we often miss a vital lesson from the book of Acts if we don't see that the Apostle Paul also struggled with discouragement. We do Paul and ourselves a great disservice if we think that Paul was somehow this superhuman person able to withstand anything without consequences. Well, I'm here to tell you that Paul was just as human as you and I are. And he experienced the same negative things that we do. And nowhere is this made more clear than when he begins his 18-month stay in the city of Corinth. If you think he had an easy time in Corinth, I recommend all you need do is read the two letters that he sent to the church there. The reason I believe Paul was so discouraged, despite some early success in that city, lays in the need for God to actually come and speak directly to him in verse 9. There's no greater sign that you need an intervention than God comes and speaks to you directly. For Paul himself writes later of his experience in Corinth in one of his own letters. He writes, "For I was with you in weakness and fear and trembling." Here is what God said to Paul in our passage today. Don't be afraid. Speak out. Don't be silent. For I am with you and no one will harm you because many people here in this city belong to me. Paul was clearly feeling kind of beat up by life and he needed God to intervene directly. And frankly, it is no wonder Paul was feeling discouraged. Just take a look at some of the stuff he faced. Now, having just arrived in Athens, the center of Greek culture and learning where he was last week, Paul makes his way alone, the 45 miles, by foot to the city of Corinth. It is pretty clear that when Paul arrives there, he's feeling very lonely. That is until God provides him two new friends, Aquila and Priscilla, who are two Jewish tent makers who were expelled from Rome. Expelled with all the other Jews from the city of Rome by decree of the emperor. Yet until this particular relationship deepens, Paul is feeling utterly alone. No wonder he needed God to come and say to him, "I'm with you." The other contributor to Paul's discouragement has to do with the city of Corinth itself. Now, the very best example I could come up with to describe this city to you is if you could imagine taking Wall Street in New York and putting it within the city of Las Vegas. And you kind of get what Corinth was like. It was commerce mixed with the pursuit of pleasure. When Paul arrives in Corinth, it had become a flourishing center of trade and commerce. And Corinth is on an isthmus, that's hard to say that word, I need Jim up here, the geographer, between the Ionian and the Aegean seas. And to avoid the long danger around the land, boats were often actually taken out of the water and transported from one sea to the other, dragged by man and horse. Thus to Corinth, men and ships came from all over the known world. Corinth had merchants and lots of money, as the main business in that city was trade. That's the Wall Street part of Corinth. But Corinth was known for something else that tainted its reputation and drew nefarious people from all over the Mediterranean. That's the Vegas part. In Corinth was the massive temple of Aphrodite, the Greek goddess of sex and love. At its height of activity, which included Paul's day, by the way, over 1,000 temple prostitutes plied their trade in the city of Corinth. And there were customers aplenty, as sailors from all over the Mediterranean really couldn't wait to take shore leave in Corinth. It's kind of similar to something I heard a few years ago about Bangkok, Thailand, where sex trade workers would make sure they knew when the American naval vessels would dock at the ports so they were ready to ply their trade. Corinth was a hotbed of drunkenness and debauchery. It was a cesspool of immorality, and it was made worse by the fact that the people who lived there didn't see anything wrong with what they were doing. The whole thing was sanctioned by the government and the religious establishment. Actually, they believed their debauchery was part of their religious duty in paying homage to Aphrodite. Visiting a temple prostitute was as routine a religious act as putting our offering in the offering plate for them. The situation in Corinth devastated Paul, wrecked him. Paul saw through the eyes of God what was really going on in Corinth for what it truly was. He knew that eventually the pursuit of pleasure and material gain would leave an emptiness in people's hearts. Such worldly pursuits blinded people to their spiritual need, and Paul was frustrated trying to deal with the populace there. And even when people did come to faith, it was very hard for them to leave their old lives behind. Just read Paul's two letters to the church to see the kind of challenges the first converts had when they joined the church. Perhaps you remember one particular example. You might remember from the letters Paul wrote a heated debate in the Corinthian church over whether it was morally right for a Christian to eat meat that was offered to idols. It's a bit confusing to us, maybe. But the issue was really ripping the Corinthian church apart. It was destroying them. The meat was very tempting to them because it might be the only meat that most of them would get on any regular basis. But would God appreciate them eating something that was offered to idols? Clearly, being new to the faith, the conscience of the Christians in Corinth were completely unsettled. But it got worse for Paul, if it could. Rome, in its bureaucratic brilliance, appointed a man named Gallio to be the governor of Achaia, which is the region that surrounds Corinth. This information actually helps us to date when Paul was in Corinth pretty accurately, because Gallio was governor from 51 to 52 AD. It also means that by now it's been 20 years since the Jerusalem church was founded. Scholars have learned a little bit about this Gallio, and what they've learned is not very flattering. He was not a mean governor, nor was he overly kind. Gallio was, in a word, simply indifferent. He didn't care about issues unless they were related to Roman rule or commerce or lining his own pockets. So indifferent was he to the concerns of others that the mob that grabbed Paul and dragged him before the governor severely beat a man named Crispus, who was the leader of the synagogue, right there in the courtroom, in front of the governor. And he didn't care. The Jews who hated Paul misjudged Gallio. They thought he could be easily swayed to get rid of Paul, but religious matters like Jewish law, they didn't mean anything to him. Even before Paul could make his defense before the governor, Gallio dismissed the whole thing, just said, "I don't care, get out." So we can see that in Corinth, Paul faced indifference, hostility, immorality, and loneliness. I can guess that at least once, probably more often than that, Paul may have wondered, "Why am I here?" But I think in his heart he knew the answer. Yes, of course, God is the one who sent him there, but think about why God sent him there. In Corinth, there lived some very sick people, spiritually speaking. Jesus, as we know, came to heal the sick and to save the lost. Maybe it was the situation in Corinth that inspired Paul when he wrote Romans 5, verse 20. God's law was given so that all people could see how sinful they were. But as people sinned more and more, God's wonderful kindness became more abundant. We all need God's grace. But if we could ever say that one group needed it more, we might say it was the people of Corinth. Paul knew they needed Christ, but he grew discouraged that he could ever make any difference at all in this place. So God steps in and talks to him, commends him to stick it out. To stick it out because God had many followers in Corinth that Paul wasn't even aware of. And many more would eventually come to faith. The stakes were very high at Corinth. The further you are away from God, the more you need Him. And the more you need God's servants to preach the gospel to them. Now, Paul likely got discouraged because he took his eye off the bigger picture. Feeling oppressed, he found his vision was focused on the immediate events and circumstances that were swirling around him. That's what discouragement does to us. Discouragement keeps us from looking beyond ourselves to the grand plan that God has for us. I ran across a story that illustrates well the need to have a bigger vision. But you might need a calculator or a pen and pencil to keep it straight. So here goes. See if I can share this with you correctly. There was an Islamic man who died. He left his 17 camels to be divided between his three sons. With me so far? Now try and follow the math because it's a bit tricky. One son was to get 1/9 of the camels. One was to get 1/2, and the other was to get 1/3 of the camels. Now, as you can see, 17 camels are not divisible by 3 or even 2. The three brothers argued long and loud about how they were going to divide these camels. And finally, in desperation, they agreed to talk to a certain wise man about what to do. They found him seated in front of his tent with his own camel staked out back. After hearing the case of the three brothers, the wise man took his own camel and added it to the 17 other camels. This confused the three young men until the wise man began to divide up the camels according to the late father's instructions. Are you ready? He gave 1/9 of the camels to the first son, that's 2. He gave 1/2 of the 18 camels to the next, that's 9. And finally, he gave 1/3 or 6 camels to the third young man. Did you keep up with the math? 2 + 9 + 6 = 17 camels. And guess what? The wise man got his own camel back. What happened there? The brothers were so engrossed in the controversy that they failed to realize that their point of reference was too small. With the simple addition of an 18th camel, the solution presented itself. The wise man's momentary sacrifice of his own camel provided a solution to the brothers at no cost to himself. That's what we need from God, you and I. We need God to enter into our circumstance and widen our perspective. A perspective that's greater than our immediate problems. I am absolutely positive that discouragement is stalking hearts here today. A discouragement that is crushing vitality, stealing joy, and hampering our walk with Jesus. There's signs all around us that it's there. You can see it in people's faces, even with masks on. You can hear it in their voices, and it's clearly demonstrated in their behavior. And so we hear, "Oh, woe is me." Or, "If it weren't for bad luck, I'd have no luck at all." Or, "Nobody loves me. Everybody hates me. I think I'll go eat some worms," as the kids used to say. If we are grumpy, if we hold a grudge, if we're threatening to take all our marbles and go home, then quite frankly, our vision is too small. If the extent of our communication with a brother or sister in Christ is to complain, then our vision is too small. If we think our problems and our issues should take top priority in other people's lives, our vision is too small. If the only thing people say to our assessment of a situation is, "Would you like some cheese with your wine?" then our vision is too small. If what matters is our comfort, our happiness, our recognition, our vision is too small. Paul was in serious danger in Corinth of becoming myopic or nearsighted. It was a very dangerous thing for him, and it helped the church not one iota. Are we not also in danger of being short-sighted? God is saying to Paul, kind of like, yeah, I know Corinth is an awful place, Paul. I know it's tough slogging to win people to me. I know you're tired, you're feeling alone, you're frustrated, but take a look at the bigger picture. Have we faith enough to see beyond ourselves to the work God's doing? Can we see the light shining in even the darkest of places, like a city that's filled with temple prostitutes? Do we care about God's work even when there are men like Galileo who are absolutely indifferent? Can we see the bigger picture through the struggles of our own daily existence? You know, there was a couple, husband and wife, who lived in London 130 years ago or so, named William and Catherine Booth. And they were a godly couple, but it seems that William was in a real quandary, wondering what God was calling him to do in ministry. At that time, Catherine Booth was a noted Bible teacher, and she was invited to go around and teach and preach all over London. And while the couple were there in London, William started taking late night walks through the slums of London's East End. William noticed that about every fifth building on his walk was a pub. And many of them, he noticed, had little steps up to the counter so that children could climb up those steps and order gin. Children. The image devastated William, and he told Catherine, I seem to hear a voice sounding in my ear. Where can you go and find such heathen as these? And where is there a greater need for our labor? Darling, I found my destiny. Later that year, 1865, the couple opened a Christian mission in the London slums. Their life's vision to reach the down and outers that other Christians simply ignored. That simple vision of two people grew into what? The Salvation Army. That's right. And which now ministers through 3 million members in 91 countries. This is the kind of vision God wanted Paul to have in the city of Corinth. I truly believe it's the kind of vision God wants you and I to have right here in Simcoe.